Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.
From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 285, for Friday, the 4th of August, 2017. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today, we travel 50 years back to 1967 for a survey of the best films of that year, and there were some good ones. It was a groundbreaking year for Hollywood. The Graduate, which launched the career of Dustin Hoffman, and with music by Simon and Garfunkel. In the Heat of the Night was Sidney Poitier, which won the Best Picture Oscar. Cool Hand Luke, Bonnie and Clyde, and guess who's coming to dinner? Our film critics Christopher Llewellyn Reid and Linda DeLibero are with us. As soon as Linda finishes her espresso, we'll get started.
This hit the spot. Thank
good.
You so
Very
much.
Good. I got Linda an espresso, so we're ready to roll here on Roughly Speaking film segment with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reid, looking back 50 years to the year 1967. I'm trying to think of the year, 1967, what happened in 1967. Vietnam War was going on. Lyndon Johnson was still president of the United States and hadn't quite yet announced that he wasn't running for re-election. Can you imagine that today?
It's nice to dream about.
It's nice to dream about it right now. But actually, a president announcing that he's not going to run for re-election would be highly unusual. He didn't think he could win because of the war.
Yeah.
And it turned out a Republican won in 1968. But in 67, the war was escalating. 1967, I was a kid in the Boston area, and the Red Sox got into the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. Yeah.
We know how that ended.
Yeah. Well, it won seven games, which no one expected. Anyway, I don't know where Chris was in 1967. I don't think he was around yet.
He was like a little twinkle in his mom's eye.
Not even. Were your parents married?
I was not even conceived. Oh, yes. I'm the second child.
Oh, okay.
I was born in 1969.
But 67 turned out to be a pretty good year for movies. And we picked five to talk about and some others that we can mention. But Bonnie and Clyde, Cool Hand Luke, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and In the Heat of the Night, the last two starring Sidney Poitier. We're going to start with Bonnie and Clyde. Warren Beatty as Clyde Barrow and Faye Dunaway as Bonnie Parker hooking up to commit some crimes in the United States in the 1920s or 30s?
30s.
In the 1930s.
Depression era. What happened was it was released in August of 67 and was fairly universally panned. There was a very famous review of the film by Bosley Crowther, who was the lead critic of the New York Times. It was scathing. There were words tossed around like imbecilic. you know, it was regarded as an ultra-violent, really despicable portrayal of these two criminals, very glamorous, this outraged critics. And Jack Warner himself, who was hoodwinked into producing the movie by Warren Beatty, also famously hated the film and so was determined to kill it. I think it was released on a double bill in the South and it just tanked. And then a couple months later in October, Pauline Kael, who
at the New Yorker,
already by that time was a famous film critic, wrote the review to end all reviews about this new kind of film that made these young, sort of innocent, fresh, beautiful people into glamorous icons, and how exciting and new and refreshing this was. And that review suddenly turned things around. Warner's was forced to bring it back. It got onto the cover of, I believe it was Time magazine, and that was when it began to take off, and it became kind of a phenomenon because it became the opening salvo in the war against old Hollywood and the birth of new Hollywood.
New Hollywood meaning, really, what does that mean? Does it mean graphic violence for one thing?
For one thing.
Don't hold back on the violence.
Don't hold back. Bringing in the youth audience that Hollywood had so far unsuccessfully been courting in the 60s. Hollywood was at a crossroads. The Paramount decision, which had taken away their exhibition arm, was in full force, and the old studio system was dying, and they didn't know what was going to replace it. They didn't know what to do. The studios were run by a bunch of old white men, which I guess you could say they still are. But Bonnie and Clyde really was the beginning of showing the way toward a youth audience, a youth market, by releasing all the holds on violence, sex. They borrowed tricks from the New Wave, the French New Wave, that was a very European-looking movie. During these chase sequences and the criminal activities, they used the famous Flatt & Scruggs soundtrack, which made it all seem very exciting and fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were being shot. And then, of course, you had this ultra-violent slow-motion ending that was unprecedented at the time.
Right.
And so this really was a watershed moment.
Indeed, a very difficult time for Hollywood for a variety of reasons. They were struggling to figure out how to recover from the twin pillars of the Paramount decision and the rise of television in the 1950s. And they'd sort of seen some alternative ways of filmmaking, first in the Italian neorealist movement and then the French New Wave movement of the late 50s. And they kept on making really increasingly bloated features. So for every successful film like The Sound of Music, you'd have a film that, though it made money, didn't make back its money, like Paint Your Wagon, right? So an incredibly bloated musical with Gene Seberg, Clint Eastwood, and Lee Marvin.
Right.
Or films like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which were also bloated, you know, mega, mega productions. And
Cleopatra.
Or Cleopatra.
Well, throw that one in.
Exactly. So they were struggling. And, you know, they were also finding that their system, based on the production code of determining content in the films, was now being increasingly ignored by filmmakers. So 1967 is the final year where the production code is officially in place. Because in 1968, the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, adopts the fledgling rating system, which was then later adapted into what we have today. So Arthur Penn, as Linda was saying, sort of led the way with Bonnie and Clyde, not only in terms of the violence within, but also in terms of many of his, you know, aesthetic choices, indeed mirroring a lot of what we'd seen in films like Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, which similarly profiles, you know, bad people in leading roles.
And then, of having course, fun.
Having fun. I mean, after this, we get films like The Wild Bunch, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, so this kind of becomes a thing with the outlaws as central characters. And it's really, you know, it's a film that stood the test of time. It's exciting. It's vibrant even to this day. It opens with a gorgeous close-up of Faye Dunaway. I wish that you know, I could have found a clip that would somehow, you know, give that sensation of Faye Dunaway's face on camera. You know, the film is exciting in so many ways. It's got great repartee between the two of them.
Well, the first clip gives away Clyde's interest in Bonnie right away, right?
Right. So this first clip happens right after Faye Dunaway, who's bored, right? So that's why I bring up the close-up. She's a woman with no prospects. She's got all this energy.
And where are we? We're in the South somewhere, right?
In
Texas.
Oh, it's in Texas. Okay, good.
She's bored, and that close-up shows this ennui and this desire for something that she can't quite articulate. And then she looks out the window, and she sees this attractive, well-dressed young man trying to steal her mother's car. And so she comes out and confronts him.
Ain't you ashamed? You're trying to steal an old lady's automobile.
Oh, come on now. What you talking about? I've been thinking about buying me one.
Bull. You ain't got money for dinner, let alone buy no car.
Well, now, I tell you something. I got enough money for Coca-Cola, and since it don't look like you're going to invite me inside...
Oh, you'd see the dining room table if I did.
Well, you won't go in town with me? How'd that be?
Well, I'm going to work anyway.
You going to work, huh?
Yeah.
What kind of work you do?
None of your business.
I bet you're a movie star. A lady mechanic?
No.
Maid?
What do you think I am?
A waitress.
What line of work you in? When you're not stealing cars.
Well, I tell you, I'm looking for suitable employment right tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Well, what'd you do before?
I was in state prison.
State prison?
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess some little old lady wasn't so nice.
It was armed robbery.
My. The things that turn up in the street these days.
Yeah, that's a good clip. And so you can kind of tell where it goes from there, right?
Right. And, you know, I mean, Warren Beatty was already a rising star at this point. But really, this film is what helped launch him and Faye Dunaway to sort of the superstardom that they both shared in the 1970s.
I had a question to follow up with Linda. When you said he had hoodwinked Jack Warner into making this film, what kind of power did Warren Beatty have as of 1967? He had Splendor in the Grass, right?
Yeah, he had smarts. That's what he had. Mm. He was
charming, too.
He was extremely charming. Yeah. He was extremely smart. He was one of these transitional stars who had really come up in the old studio system and knew it very well. And did indeed star in, Splendor in the Grass, I guess, was his first big film. But he was in the Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, playing gigolos and glamour boy parts, as you can imagine. And he really wanted to escape from that. He, I believe, got the property from Robert Benton and David Newman, who wrote the screenplay. They were both young writers at Esquire magazine, who had grown up with the myth of Bonnie and Clyde. And they got him interested in it, and then he wanted François Truffaut to direct it initially. Truffaut, for one reason or another, couldn't do it. He ended up with Arthur Penn, who had also been around for quite a while. And he took it to Warner. I don't even remember what it was that Warner was thinking. You know, he was an old guy at this point.
He didn't want to make the film.
No, not particularly.
But at the same time, the studios knew that they were not being successful. So I'm sure that motivated that initial decision of
try something new.
It was sort of like, we'll try anything. And Warner famously, when he saw a preview of a film, you knew that he hated the film by how many times he went, got up and went to the bathroom, and apparently he spent most of the time in the john and was really upset about this whole thing. But, you know, it was that moment, which is actually documented in a wonderful book by Mark Harris called Pictures at a Revolution, which is about the 67 Academy Award nominees. And it's a brilliant book about this transitional year.
Thanks for mentioning it. Pictures at a Revolution.
Yeah, and he tells a lot of stories about the making of these movies. Hmm. And it's really all about old Hollywood encountering new Hollywood and this seismic change that really happened quite quickly in the space of a couple of years.
I'd like to make a second book recommendation. It's Peter Biskin's Easy Riders, mm-hmm. Raging Bulls, and I think the subtitle is How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. Also very good about this transitional period and filled with lots of salacious gossip if you enjoy that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely.
The next clip from Bonnie and Clyde, I gave it a slug. I'm no stud. That's what I call it. I'm not sure if that's the exact line from the clip, but that's what I called it. I'm no stud.
Right. So they have an interesting relationship. And as she says right before this clip, right, he advertises well, but can't quite follow through. So he suffers from some sexual dysfunction throughout the film, which, you know, we could hypothesize perhaps is what leads him to want to play around with an actual physical gun so much. But it doesn't matter because they form this bond beyond the sexual, which is built out of their mutual yearning for something beyond their extremely humble origins. And in this little bit of dialogue, you basically hear Clyde pitch to Bonnie what their future could be like together.
All right. If all you want's a stud service, you get on back to West Dallas and you stay there the rest of your life. You're worth more than that, a lot more than that, and you know it, and that's why you come along with me. You can find a lover boy on every damn corner in town. It don't make a damn to them whether you're waiting on tables or picking cotton, but it does make a damn to me.
Why?
Why? What you mean, why? Because you're different, that's why. You know, you're like me, you want different things. You got something better than being a waitress. You and me traveling together, we could cut a path clean across this state and Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma, and everybody'd know about it. You listen to me, Miss Bonnie Parker. You listen to me. Now, how would you like to go walking in the dining room of the Dolphus Hotel in Dallas wearing a nice silk dress and have everybody waiting on you? Do you like that? Does that seem like a lot to ask? That ain't enough for you. You got a right to that.
Hey, when did you figure all that up?
The minute I saw you.
How do you think this film holds up after 50 years?
I still teach it, and my students still like it. And I think, actually, now, in this political moment, it would have a lot of resonance because the film, in part, caught on so well because there is a political thread running through it. It does take place during the Depression, and it becomes a kind of Robin Hood thing that we are, in our bank robberies, we are really championing the people who have been robbed by these banks. And so Bonnie and Clyde were countercultural heroes in 1967 because they did seem like they were, you know, sticking it to the man. So I think today that certainly would not have lost its appeal and, in fact, would have even more appeal than it might have, say, you know, 6 or 7 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Last year's Hell or High Water had not dissimilar themes within it. Mm-hmm. I just want to point out that the film also features an early performance by Gene Hackman and another Gene Wilder. So there are a lot of good people.
Gene Wilder is in Bonnie and Clyde?
He is. Small role.
So is Michael J. Pollack.
Yes, so is Michael J. Pollack. But Gene Wilder is this hapless...
Wow.
He's an undertaker.
That's what it is, yes.
And you mentioned Gene Hackman.
That's right.
Who came late to acting, right? Didn't he start acting when he was in his late 30s or something?
Yeah, he's no spring chicken in the film, but it's still early in his movie career. He's very good.
I was going to say, that must have been... right when he got started.
It is, yeah.
Wow. Yep. Bonnie and Clyde. Cool Hand Luke is next, also from 1967, starring Paul Newman as Luke. You a good old boy, Luke! And George Kennedy, of course. And who's the man who delivers the famous line that we're going to hear from the first clip today?
That's
Strother Martin.
Yeah. So Luke is a troublemaker. I think the opening scene of this film, he's cutting... parking meter heads off, isn't he, with a hacksaw?
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
It kind of reminds me of a scene in a Jim Jarmusch film called Down by Law, where I think someone is robbing parking meters in the beginning of the film. But anyway, I have a vague memory of it. I'm sorry, but that's how
I think you're right.
I believe this is how Cool Hand Luke starts.
It is, and it also sort of it's almost like an echo. Also, something like Rebel Without a Cause, which opens with a drunk James Dean sort of misbehaving in the street. This is more serious, but you know, both films feature these, you know, effective rebels without a cause. In the case of Cool Hand Luke, he suffers more for it, but he becomes sort of a symbol of the, you know, rebellion of the late 60s against authority.
That's basically what he's about, right?
That is correct, yeah.
You kind of like him for it, but you think, why do you keep getting in trouble, Luke? Of course, there wouldn't be a movie if you didn't. But of course, I'm very close to this film, Cold Hand Luke. I don't like what happened to Paul Newman in this film, but he kept asking for trouble. So go ahead, Linda. I defer to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, that little phrase that Strother Martin utters, which we will hear in a minute, became a kind of rallying cry for the new left because it speaks this moment of crisis when the old and the young have irrevocably parted ways.
Well, let's go right to it then. What's the setup? Luke's in trouble again, right?
Luke's been getting, he's in prison after the events of the opening, and he keeps on getting in more trouble in prison because he keeps on mouthing off to the authorities in the prison, and in this case, he mouths off to the captain, who we'll hear, hits him a few times, knocks him to the ground, and then the captain utters his immortal line, which we'll hear.
You're going to get used to wearing them chains after a while, Luke. Don't you never stop listening to them clinking. But they're going to remind you of what I've been saying for your own good.
Wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain.
Don't you ever talk that way to me. Never! Never! What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach. So you get what we had here last week, which is the way he wants it. Well, he gets it. And I don't like it any more than you, man.
I remember it was all about these very clear signals that he was a Christ figure being sacrificed on the altar of this overbearing hand of the law. Right. And what could be more appealing than someone like Paul Newman in a role like that, who is just absolutely irresistible? And that was the other thing. You've got these criminals being portrayed by very glamorous, beautiful stars and making it look very, very attractive to be against everything, you know? What are you against? What do you got?
That's very interesting, because I'm trying to think of all these other films that Paul Newman was in. Is there any role like Cool Hand Luke?
Yeah, well, he played Billy the Kid in The Left-Handed Gun. Mm-hmm. I think that's the title of the film.
And then, of course, Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid.
Yeah. And in Hud, he's not exactly an appealing
character. He's really
nasty. Yeah. You know what's interesting about this film for Paul Newman? So it's 1967, mm-hmm. and on the screen, he's still playing a character that you're meant to believe is on the younger side.
Right.
2 years later, he makes the sort of official transition to more mature roles with Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. And from then on, he's still an icon. He's still a gorgeous leading man. But now he's playing men. And before that, he was sort of playing man boys.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's like 2 years he sort of embraces, because he almost looks middle-aged. I mean, good-looking, but middle-aged in Butch. And then he does The Sting in the 70s. So he just, mm-hmm. it's like this moment of transition in his own career mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, and he, again, is one of those transitional actors who was very much a part of the old studio system, but was one of the early method actors. You know, this is a guy who came up in the mid-50s. This is not a spring chicken in 1967.
And he'd done some stage work, right?
A lot of stage work, studied at the Actors Studio, and he is suddenly playing roles that are definitely tilted toward a younger crowd, even though he's no longer, I mean, he's no longer a young actor.
Right.
He's sort of, it's as if, I don't know, you know, James Dean, if he had lived and matured a little bit,
mm-hmm.
that would have been maybe the career that he might have had.
Hud the Hustler is another one.
That's right.
Cat in a Hot Tin Roof.
That's very true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he by no means played, you know, perfect. He was no 1930s era James Stewart. Let's just
right.
put it that
and
way.
Not simply the like romantic lead.
That is correct.
Right?
Yeah, he was always sort of neurosis behind him.
Edgy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah. And you know, I you know, speaking of the year of my birth, right? I've always been a huge fan of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I mean, mm-hmm. that is one of my favorite. And that was actually my first view of Paul Newman ever as a kid.
Who are those guys?
Yeah, I love that
love
movie.
Love that movie.
2 years from now, we'll have to do an anniversary show on that.
That's 69.
69.
Yep.
Yeah. The Graduate is a 1967 film. It was released in December. I thought it was 1968. For some reason, I associated it with that year, and I looked it up, and it was December release. Dustin Hoffman, and you just mentioned Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Catherine Ross was in The Graduate in 1967, along with Anne Bancroft. Buck Henry was in it, too.
And Buck Henry co-wrote the script, he plays in that wonderful scene. He plays the hotel clerk. I love that scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in one of my favorite movies.
Well,
this is one of my favorite
We're
going
to get to that.
Yeah.
I call that the toothbrush scene.
Yeah.
But okay, let's start with the famous, this is sort of the opening, right?
This is
the graduation party for Dustin Hoffman, and a very famous line from the film that you'll hear in a moment.
Yeah, so just before we get there, I just want to point out that, you know, this film is so important for so many reasons. It's the number one film box office wise of 1967, and it launched the career of Dustin Hoffman, and that launch helped change the face of the Hollywood leading man. And then in the 1970s, we get people like Al Pacino. We would never have had an Al Pacino without Dustin Hoffman. So the film is so important in so many ways, and it talks about generational shifts, which of course is an integral part of the culture of the 1960s. So in this opening scene, poor Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, is at a loss of what to do next after having just graduated from college. And he's at this party in his honor, in his parents' house, and everybody wants to congratulate him, and he just wants to be alone. He keeps on trying to get away from the party, and we'll hear this friend of his parents take him aside and offer him just the advice he needs to be a success in the future.
Ben, we're all so proud of you.
Proud.
What are you going to do now?
I was going to go upstairs for a minute.
Oh, I meant with your future.
Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
Ben.
Excuse me. Mr. McGuire.
Come with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. Excuse us, Joanne.
Of course. Please.
Thank you. I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Enough said. That's a deal.
And then at what point in the film do we get Anne Bancroft, do we get pick up quickly that Anne Bancroft is after Dustin Hoffman? Do you remember how that happens?
Very soon.
Yeah.
Well, she basically asks him to take her home right after this scene with plastics.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And that's how we get to her house and the next scene, which is very funny.
But, right.
They're all funny.
And it's so important in this scene to keep in mind that there's a very important visual that was the idea of the cinematographer and the art director to sort of create this wonderful, it's used in all the posters, triangle of Anne Bancroft's knee through which we see poor Benjamin Braddock as he is a pawn in her game of seduction.
His hands in his pockets.
It's a great visual. Yeah. And so Anne Bancroft, who was not much older than Dustin Hoffman making this film, but plays a woman who's a generation older, is seducing / not seducing young Benjamin Braddock. So she's had him bring her home, and then this scene happens.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Well, no, I hadn't thought of it.
So then Mrs. Robinson wants Benjamin to meet her at a hotel, and she wants him to register for the hotel room, right?
That is correct. And the poor guy, he has tried to interact first with the hotel desk clerk, but lost his nerve. So he went off to some wedding party because he couldn't quite ask for a room. And then he comes back hoping to talk to a different desk clerk and is about to speak to this different desk clerk, who walks away and out pops the desk clerk from earlier, Buck Henry,
right.
One of the screenwriters
of the
film.
Yes, sir?
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
Where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Linda, so what is so special about this film?
Yeah, and again, I think it has to do with the frankness, the sexual frankness, which you couldn't have had but a few short years before this. It also has to do with a clear connection with a whole generation's feeling of ennui and disconnection, disorientation. This is a young upper middle class guy from Los Angeles whose parents are from a generation that just doesn't get it. And so he's completely alienated from his surroundings, from his family. And in this moment of desperation, he succumbs to the seduction by this very troubled woman, it turns out. And I gotta say, big shout out to Anne Bancroft, because I think she was just absolutely extraordinary. And this was something that any young person could really identify with. You know, there are all these scenes of Benjamin sitting in his room alone, gazing at his fish tank.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that's cringeworthy sense of embarrassment that you have been born into this privileged world and you don't know what to do with that. So, and of course, his rebellion against all of that by finally just, you know, going after this young woman who is the daughter of the woman he's been sleeping with for months.
Yes, it's not really clear to me. I saw this film a couple of years ago, how much he liked, how attracted he was to Catherine Ross's character. Right? He was a little ambivalent about her, for her mother.
Yeah.
And then what? Am I right or not?
At first he's ambivalent, but then he at least convinces himself that she is the solution to his problems. But then the film ends on that wonderful scene where after they finally escape,
right,
they're left alone in the bus, and both of their happy expressions sort of fade into the stoniness that we've come to associate with Benjamin's character. So who knows? It's a wonderful open ending. And, you know, maybe he is still ambivalent.
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, this undermining of the happy ending, which is so exciting, you know, this breathtaking chase to the church and wresting her away from these horrible people. And then you have the aftermath, which you don't see in most films, at least not up until that point. You know, what do these guys know about each other? What do
right.
they have in common?
Right.
This is an impulse move, and look at the quote-unquote happy marriages surrounding them. It's looking pretty grim at the very end.
It's a really excellent ending.
Yes.
It leaves you hanging there thinking, well, what does happen next?
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, no one's ever made a sequel.
But they joked about it in The Player in Robert Altman's 1991 film about Hollywood.
Yeah. With Tim Robbins?
Yes.
They joke about making a sequel to
Buck
The Graduate.
Henry is in the film basically
right.
playing
yeah.
himself.
That's right.
And he pitches a sequel where the two of them are now living with Mrs. Robinson in her old age. And
there was a film that I've suppressed the title of because it wasn't that good, with Kevin Costner and Shirley MacLaine, where Kevin Costner plays a grown-up version of the supposedly real-life Benjamin Braddock, and Shirley MacLaine is the real-life Mrs.
Really?
Robinson. Yeah.
What film was that?
Yeah, I can't remember the title, but it wasn't very good.
Okay.
So that's a quasi-sequel. But the other great thing about the film, of course, beyond the breakout performance by Dustin Hoffman, is the music, the soundtrack
yes.
by
oh, yeah.
Simon and Garfunkel,
yeah,
which helps elevate the film to iconic status as well. And if we think about the fact that the character as written in the original source novel was supposed to look more like a Robert Redford
yes.
type,
and
the Benjamin Braddock.
And who was, in fact, their first choice.
Right. And then you think about what a different film it would be
if he had a handsome guy like Robert
right,
Redford
and
at that
Mike
time.
Mike Nichols,
yeah.
you know, really took a chance
yeah.
casting Dustin Hoffman, and it's thank God
yeah.
because the quality that Hoffman brings. I mean,
yeah,
yeah.
His nervousness, the hotel scene, and all the seduction scenes, really
yeah,
convincing,
really
yeah.
amazing, and
yeah.
that it really was an extraordinary move to have Simon and Garfunkel do that soundtrack. That kind of thing had never really happened before, and then you begin to see it more and more. Simon and Garfunkel created some of that music for the movie. Some of it they had already recorded. But this idea of using contemporary music, music that people would actually listen to on the radio, music that young people responded to. That was...
That's a new form of marketing of Hollywood.
Yep, new way.
Because actually, in 1967 or 68, you might have heard the announcer on a radio station say, you know, Mrs. Robinson yeah. from the film The Graduate. Mm-hmm. Said, oh, well, I guess I got to go see that film. That was something new. Speaking of something new... Interracial marriage presented in a film. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 1967. This was really groundbreaking. It was a great cast. Sidney Poitier, Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy. And then the young woman who plays the fiancée of Sidney Poitier, a young white woman. Katharine Houghton?
Yes, who was Katharine Hepburn's real-life niece.
Hmm.
I think that was a first and a last for
okay.
her.
Okay, yeah, I've never heard of her. Except for this film.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about this. I mean, when I say groundbreaking, truly it was, no?
Indeed, and it's directed by Stanley Kramer, a man that we talked about in a few shows back because he was the producer of High Noon. He'd become a director in 1955, I think, and had made films like The Defiant Ones with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis. He had also made one of the bloated films of the 60s, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But here, he's making a film that, you know, hasn't aged well in all regards. It's a little too on the nose, a little too corny, but, you know, for its time, it was indeed very groundbreaking, and it features the final performance of Spencer Tracy, who died just about 2 weeks after the film wrapped. And, of course, it's a great performance by Sidney Poitier, a great performance by Katharine Hepburn, and, of course, Hepburn and Tracy had a long-standing relationship both on and off-screen, so it's sort of a farewell between them as well. And it's a film that, you know, 1967, an African-American man and a white woman, you know, kissing on screen. We see them kissing in the rearview mirror. That's it. But the idea of the two of them getting married, even though he is basically superhuman, you know, he's a world-renowned medical doctor, and yet even that aside, it's still problematic. So, yeah, it's an important film.
And the opening clip here, well, I don't know if it's the opening scene, but it's the first clip we're going to offer you. This is when he actually meets Katharine Hepburn, the mother of his fiancée.
Right, and up until this point, the Katharine Houghton character has been saying, oh, there's no problem, my parents are liberal, they're going to love you. And of course, it's not so simple, and they come in, and it's actually quite shocking for Katharine Hepburn to see Sidney.
Mrs. Drayton, I'm medically qualified, so I hope you wouldn't think it presumptuous if I say you ought to sit down before you fall down, I mean.
He thinks you're going to faint because he's a Negro.
Well, I don't think I'm going to faint, but I'll sit down anyway. Can't we all sit down? I suppose it would be all right if I said, my goodness, wouldn't it? Well, my goodness.
My goodness, I mean, that is a funny scene. Sidney Poitier was at the height of his popularity at this time, was he not?
Mm-hmm.
To Sir with Love, Lilies of the Field.
Lilies of the Field in 1963, yeah. I think, is what he won his Oscar for.
Yeah.
One of his first films was 1950, so he'd been No Way Out by Joseph Mankiewicz. So
right.
He'd been around
You mentioned
for
the
a while.
Defiant Ones.
Mm-hmm. Defiant Ones in the 1957.
Yeah.
He was, you know, the African-American face of Hollywood in terms of leading man. You know, he it's a big burden to carry, but he carried it as best he could on his mm-hmm. two strong shoulders.
Yes, and took a lot of flack for it from pretty much everywhere.
Well, this was the time of Radical Chic,
yes.
and the Black Panthers and the Vietnam War
Panthers,
and
so he was
the Civil Rights Movement and Malcolm X, and, right?
Yeah, and he was the white man's boy, according to more, you know, more radical members of the left. And I think, in fact, he was incredibly courageous to have soldiered through and done what no other African-American actor had done within the parameters of what was allowed back then. You know, he's pretty amazing and just such a great actor.
That kind of takes us to the next clip beautifully in a way. I have it noted here as a Black Power clip.
This is actually, for me, there are two scenes that I find really interesting with Sidney Poitier in this movie, and this is one of them. And that it's so he's being confronted by the maid of this, you know, upper middle class white family, played by Isabel Sanford, who would later go on to great fame and acclaim as Mrs. Jefferson on the 10-year run show of The Jeffersons,
right.
1975 mm-hmm. and 1985. And she's raised the Catherine Houghton character from the time she was a girl. And I think it's really interesting as it delves into the sort of, you know, internecine racial politics within the black community.
And class.
And class is the issues mm-hmm. of class as well. And I just I like the fact that this scene is in the film because it helps clarify that nothing's as simple, nothing's as one-dimensional as you may think. And why should it be?
How do you do, Miss Binks?
I got something to say to you, boy. Just exactly what you're trying to pull here.
I'm not trying to pull anything. I was looking to find me a wife.
Ain't that just likely? You want to answer me something? What kind of doctor you supposed to be anyhow?
Would you believe horse?
Oh, you make with witticisms and all, huh? Well, let me tell you something. You may think you're fooling Miss Joey and her folks, but you ain't fooling me for a minute. You think I don't see what you are? You're one of those smooth-talking, smart-ass niggas just out for all you can get with your black power and all that other troublemaking nonsense. And you listen here. I brought up that child from a baby in her cradle, and ain't nobody gonna harm a nun while I'm here watching. And as long as you are anywhere around this house, I'm right here watching. You read me, boy? You bring any trouble in here, and you just like to find out what black power really means. And furthermore to that, you ain't even all that good-looking.
Now, another strong scene here is Sidney Poitier with his father, right?
And that is my second favorite scene okay. in the film, in a way, just because it's about, you know, the intergenerational conflict. You know, we think that this is a film about white versus black, but it's as much a conflict between generations. And so, you know, Sidney Poitier is having as much trouble with his own parents over the fact that he's marrying a young white woman as Catherine Houghton is having with her parents. And here, his father, just before the scene, has basically told Sidney Poitier, "You owe me everything." And Sidney Poitier is like, "No, Dad, that's not true.
Let me tell you something. I owe you nothing. If you carried that bag a million miles, you did what you were supposed to do. Because you brought me into this world. And from that day, you owed me everything you could ever do for me. Like I will owe my son if I ever have another. But you don't own me. You can't tell me when or where I'm out of line. Or try to get me to live my life according to your rules. You don't even know what I am, Dad. You don't know who I am. You don't know how I feel, what I think. And if I try to explain it the rest of your life, you will never understand. You are 30 years older than I am. You and your whole lousy generation believes the way it was for you is the way it's got to be. And not until your whole generation has lain down and died will the dead weight of you be off our backs. You understand? You've got to get off my back.
And now we arrive at what would be the denouement of Spencer Tracy's Hollywood career.
Yeah, this
am
is
I
it.
Right? He died 2 weeks after they wrapped this film.
Yes.
And this is, I don't know what the order of production was, but this...
It was the last scene, I think, that they shot.
It was? Okay.
So, and at that point, he was so ill that he could barely make it onto the set. And everybody knew this in Hollywood, and you can see in the reaction shots, particularly from Katharine Hepburn, that they are reacting to the sight of Spencer Tracy most likely giving his very last performance, his very last moment on a Hollywood set after this long career. So aside from what you think of the movie or the politics of it or whether it's old-fashioned or new or, you know, the kind of soft-pedaling of the racial issues, this moment is, you know, it's pretty stirring. So,
it is.
Yeah.
Let's listen.
Anybody could make a case, and a hell of a good case, against your getting married. The arguments are so obvious that nobody has to make them. But you're two wonderful people who happened to fall in love and happened to have a pigmentation problem. And I think that now, no matter what kind of a case some bastard could make against your getting married, there would be only one thing worse. And that would be if, knowing what you two are, knowing what you two have, and knowing what you two feel, you didn't get married.
So this turned out to be a big year for Sidney Poitier. Two big films. In December, guess who's coming to dinner, but a few months before that, in August, In the Heat of the Night with Rod Steiger.
Which won Best Picture that year.
Yeah.
A film by Norman Jewison, in which Sidney Poitier plays a Philadelphia police officer who is minding his own business, waiting for a train in a southern town, and he gets picked up by a white police officer for the murder of a well-known, albeit dissipated, local white resident, and is brought into the police station in the middle of the night. It's like 4 in the morning. They wonder what he's doing there. He says he's waiting for a train. They say, there are no trains at 4 in the morning, and just at that moment, we hear a train. So the racist sheriff, played by Rod Steiger, starts to question him, only to discover that he's a police officer. And then Sidney Poitier's supervisor back in Philadelphia tells him, go ahead and help these good folks down there solve this murder. And that's how the film proceeds.
Let's go to that interrogation scene. Rod Steiger, is very suspicious of this black guy in a suit who has a fair amount of money on him, right? So let's listen to that scene.
Why don't you tell me how you killed Mr. Colbert, and I promise you, you're going to feel a whole lot better.
I was visiting my mother. I came in on the 12:35 from Brownsville. I was waiting to go out on the 405.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the meanwhile, you just killed yourself a white man, just about the most important white man we got around here, and picked yourself up a couple of $100s.
I earned that money 10 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Colored can't earn that kind of money, boy. Hell, that's more than I make in a month. Now, where did you earn it?
Philadelphia.
Mississippi?
Pennsylvania.
Not just what you do up there, little old Pennsylvania, earn that kind of money.
I'm a police officer.
And then Sidney Poitier's boss in Philly, Virgil Tibbs' boss in Philly, says, hey, work with these guys. Stay there and help them solve this murder. And he starts working on it. And he comes up with some stuff that Rod Steiger still doesn't, he's still skeptical about, right?
And then in this scene, Rod Steiger's deputies have started to realize that, hey, Tibbs is on to something. But because it's this black officer from the north, Rod Steiger's character is not too happy about it. And so they have this second confrontation.
The Verge here, Chief, he thinks that Harvey's innocent.
Well, I'll be damned. Could I talk to you about it in private?
No, you can't talk to me about it in privacy because I got Colbert's wallet right here in my hand. We took it from Harvey Overs. You don't think he gave it to him, do you?
I don't know, but Overs could have come along after the crime, found it, picked it up. I don't know.
That's what the boy said he did.
Well, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I said different.
Well, when I examined the deceased, it was obvious that the fatal blow was struck from an angle of 17 degrees from the right, which makes it almost certain the person who did it is right-handed.
So what?
Old Harv's left-handed, Chief. Everybody in town knows that.
Yeah, that's what we figured out, Chief. Harvey's a lefty, uh-huh.
Well, you're pretty sure of yourself, ain't you, Virgil? Virgil, that's a funny name for a nigger boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
Famous line from Hollywood history, right? They call me Mr. Tibbs. Was this film shot on location?
Yes, in part. It really was shot in a southern town. I don't remember exactly where, somewhere maybe in Mississippi. And I do remember reading that Sidney Poitier felt very threatened by the atmosphere. I think there were threats made to the production because he was there, and a great deal of hostility among the locals, especially given the subject matter, which is really about this ignorant white deputy coming up against this, you know, smart alecky Negro from the north who obviously knows way more about what he's doing.
And remember what year this was, 1967.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Things are still pretty scary down there. Mm-hmm. Really, I mean, it was a very scary shoot. I remember reading about that.
Well, speaking of scary, it gets kind of scary in this next scene, right?
That's right. So they, both Steiger and Poitier, go to the home of this wealthy white landowner whose not-so-distant ancestors were probably slave owners, because it's basically a plantation and all the servants on this house are African-American. And he's clearly used to having his own way, particularly around people of color. And here you have this uppity northern black police officer questioning him directly. And we'll hear in the scene the sound of this wealthy white landowner, played by Larry Gates, slapping Sidney Poitier when he asks too probing a question. And Sidney Poitier slaps him right back.
Why'd you two come here?
To ask you about Mr. Colbert.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your Your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
What are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Yeah, I remember that scene. It's really a compelling scene. Great movie. And it was the best movie of 1967, according to the Academy Awards.
Right? It was. And there was a sequel in the early 70s, which I've never seen, which is actually called They Call Me Mr. Tibbs.
That's right.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And then later there was a television show called In the Heat of the Night. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course,
I've seen this film a few times.
Yeah, Sidney Poitier became a director in the 70s, made films like Uptown Saturday Night and Stir Crazy.
Hmm.
So. Yeah.
And what's become of Sidney Poitier? We don't hear much about him anymore, do we?
He's out there somewhere.
He's not that young, and I think he's enjoying retirement. Yeah. Mm. But he was at the Oscars when Denzel Washington won Best Actor for Training Day, and Denzel Washington paid tribute to him. Mm. So, yeah.
1967, also the year of Disney's Jungle Book. Just to make a note of it. Are there any other films you wanted to mention?
That was the number two film of the year, actually, The Jungle Book.
Was it? Yeah, I'm not surprised, because I went about 10 times.
It was the last movie that Walt Disney personally signed off on.
Oh, really?
And then he died.
Right.
It's also The Dirty Dozen came out in 1967.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know a couple of other little tidbits about 1967? IMAX made its debut at Expo 67 in Montreal.
Wow.
And the MGM's Vault Number 7 burned, which was a notorious moment because I don't know how many hundreds of silent and early sound films were destroyed.
Oh, that's the year that happened?
Destroyed.
Wow.
So it was kind of the old Hollywood really did burn to the ground.
It really is a transitional moment then.
Yes.
I like when we do these anniversary shows. This one was well worth doing.
Indeed,
those
yeah.
are some excellent films.
This is a great year.
Well worth remembering.
Yeah. Chris, Linda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan, as always.
Linda DeLibero is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed is Chair and Professor in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. They join us once a month to talk about cinema past, present, and future. That's our show for now. Join us for the next edition of Roughly Speaking sometime next week. Have a great weekend. For producer Steve Early, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again soon.
Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Hiding in a hiding place where no one ever goes. It's a little secret, just the Robinson's affair. Most of all, you've got to hide it from the kids. Coo-coo-ca-choo, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
from the day's debate. Laugh about it, shout about it, when you've got to choose. Every way you look at it, you lose. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you. What's that you say, Mrs. Robinson? Joe to Joe has left us.